I'm feeling very honored and challenged to be here tonight, to be here to honor Emily Dickinson, to be here as part of this event as a whole, and I feel very challenged to be following a great woman and a great poet, Gwendolyn Brooks. I'm going to start by reading a poem of mine in the middle of which Emily Dickinson appears, and in the middle of which I address her. It's not entirely of or about her. I had written a poem back in the 60s, the early 60s, addressed to her, called "I Am in Danger, Sir," a quotation from a letter she had written to Thomas Higginson. He reproves her meters, and she writes to him and says, "You think my gait spasmodic. I am in danger, sir." But I'm not going to read that poem. I'm going to read the last poem that I have written for her, and I mean by that the last. That's what this poem is all about. In between, I wrote a long essay about her when all of her work finally became obtainable in its original versions. And I began to study it for the first time as a huge body of work containing many unexpected and remarkable poems which were nowhere anthologized and which weren't even being talked about. The name of this poem of mine is The Spirit of Place, and I started writing it when with my woman friend, lover, comrade, I moved into the valley in western Massachusetts where Emily Dickinson was born and lived all of her life. And I was occasionally asked, half jokingly, if I had moved there to be near Emily, and I acerbically answered no. This is the spirit of place. And parts of this poem are addressed to my friend, lover, and comrade, and parts of the poem are addressed to Emily Dickinson. Over the hills in Shutesbury, Leverett, driving with you in spring, rode like a stream bed unwinding downhill, fiddlehead ferns uncurling, spring peepers ringing sweet and cold, while we talk yet again of dark and light, of blackness, whiteness, numbness rammed through the heart like a stake, trying to pull apart the threads from the dried blood of the old murderous uncaring, halting on bridges in bloodlight where the freshets call out freedom to frog-thrilling swamp, skunk cabbage, trying to sense the conscience of these hills, knowing how the single-minded, pure solutions bleached and desiccated within their perfect flasks. For it was not enough to be New England, as every event since has testified. New England's a shadow country, always was. It was not enough to be for abolition, while the spirit of the masters flickered in the abolitionist's heart. It was not enough to name ourselves anew, while the spirit of the masters calls the freed woman to forget the slave. With whom do you believe your lot is cast? If there's a conscience in these hills, it hurls that question, unquenched, relentless, to our ears, wild and witch-like, ringing every swamp. The mountain laurel in bloom, constructed like needlework, tiny half-pulled stitches piercing flushed and stippled petals. Here in these woods it grows wild. Midsummer moonrise turns it opal. The night breathes with its clusters. Protected species, meaning endangered. Here in these hills, this valley, we have felt a kind of freedom, planting the soil, have known hours of a calm, intense, and mutual solitude, reading and writing, trying to clarify, connect, past and present, near and far, the Alabama quilt, the Botswana basket, history, the dark crumble of last year's compost, filtering softly through your living hand. But here as well, we face instantaneous violence, ambush, male dominion on a back road, to escape in a locked car, windows shut, skimming the ditch, your split-second survival reflex, taking on the world as it is, not as we wish it, as it is, not as we work for it to be. Strangers are an endangered species. In Emily Dickinson's house in Amherst, cocktails are served. The scholars gather in celebration. Their pious or clinical legends festoon the walls like imitations of period patterns. And this is from Emily Dickinson. And as I feared, my life was made a victim. The remnants pawed, the relics, the cult assembled in the bedroom, and you, whose teeth were set on edge by churches, resist your shrine, escape, are found nowhere, unless in words, your own. And this is from a letter of hers. All we are strangers, dear. The world is not acquainted with us because we are not acquainted with her. And pilgrims, do you hesitate? And soldiers oft, some of us victors, but those I do not see tonight owing to the smoke. We are hungry and thirsty sometimes. We are barefoot and cold. This place is large enough for both of us. The river fog will do for privacy. This is my third and last address to you. With the hands of a daughter, I would cover you from all intrusion, even my own, saying, rest to your ghost. With the hands of a sister, I would leave your hands open or closed as they prefer to lie, and ask no more of who or why or wherefore. With the hands of a mother, I would close the door on the rooms you've left behind and silently pick up my fallen work. The river fog will do for privacy on the low road, a breath here, there, a cloudiness floating on the blacktop. Sunflower heads turned black and bowed, the seas of corn a stubble, the old routes flowing north, if not to freedom. No human figure now in sight. With whom do you believe your lot is cast? Only the functional figure of the scarecrow, the cut corn ground to shreds, heaped in a shape like an Indian burial mound, a haunted-looking, ordinary thing. The work of winter starts fermenting in my head. How with the hands of a lover or a midwife to hold back till the time is right. Force nothing, be unforced. Accept no giant miracles of growth by counterfeit light. Trust roots, allow the days to shrink. Give credence to these slender means. Wait without sadness and with grave impatience. Here in the north, where winter has a meaning, where the heaped colors suddenly go ashen, where nothing is promised, learn what an underground journey has been, might have to be. Speak in a winter code. Let fog, sleet translate, wind carry them. Orion plunges like a drunken hunter over the Mohawk Trail, a parallelogram slashed with two cuts of steel. A night so clear that every constellation stands out from an undifferentiated cloud of stars, a kind of aura. All the figures up there look violent to me, as a pogrom on Christmas Eve in some old country. I want our own Earth, not the satellites, our world as it is, if not as it might be. Then, as it is, male dominion, gang rape, lynching, pogrom, the Mohawk wraiths in their tracts of leafless birch watching, will we do better? The tests I need to pass are prescribed by the spirits of place who understand travel but not amnesia. The world as it is, not as her users boast, damaged beyond reclamation by their using, ourselves as we are in these painful motions of staying cognizant, some part of us always out beyond ourselves, knowing, knowing, knowing. Are we all in training for something we don't name, to exact reparation for things done long ago to us and to those who did not survive what was done to them, whom we ought to honor with grief, with fury, with action? On a pure night, on a night when pollution seems absurdity, when the undamaged planet seems to turn like a bowl of crystal in black ether, they are the piece of us that lies out there, knowing, knowing, knowing. The rest of the poems I'm going to read are from this new book, which is just out, literally. And so I'm very happy to be reading from a copy of it here tonight. I just got it in my hands today. And this book, which is called Your Native Land, Your Life. And I guess it, too, is all about the spirit of place, of many places. Well, these are three short poems called Poetry. Poetry 1. Someone at a table under a brown metal lamp is studying the history of poetry. Someone in the library at closing time has learned to say, modernism, trope, Vatic, text. She is listening for shreds of music. He is searching for his name back in the old country. They cannot learn without teachers. They are like us, what we were, if you remember. In a corner of night, a voice is crying in a kind of whisper, more. Can you remember when we thought the poets taught how to live? That is not the voice of a critic, nor a common reader. It is someone young, in anger, hardly knowing what to ask, who finds our lines, our glosses, wanting in this world. And this is called Poetry 2, Chicago. I call it that partly because there used to be a magazine called Poetry Chicago. I think there still is. I never see it anymore. But it was very important to me at one time in my life. Chicago has been a city of poets. You've just heard one of them. And I was staying with my son in Chicago when I wrote this poem. Whatever a poet is, at the point of conception, is conceived in these projects of beige and gray bricks. Yes, poets are born in wasted tracts like these. Whatever color, sex, comes to term in this winter's driving nights. And the child pushes like a spear, a cry through cracked cement, through zero air, a spear, a cry of green. Yes, poets endure these schools of fear, balked yet unbroken, where so much gets broken, trust, windows, pride, the mother tongue. Wherever a poet is born, enduring depends on the frailest of chances. Who listened to your murmuring over your little rubbish? Who let you be? Who gave you the books? Who let you know you were not alone? Showed you the twist of old strands, raffia, hemp, or silk? The beaded threads, the fiery lines, saying, this belongs to you. You have the right. You belong to the song of your mothers and fathers. You have a people. This is Poetry 3. Even if we knew the children were all asleep and healthy, the ledgers balanced, the water running clear in the pipes, and all the prisons free, even if every word we wrote by then were honest, the sheer heft of our living behind it, not these sometimes lax, indolent lines, these litanies. Even if we were told, not just by friends, that this was honest work, even if each of us didn't wear a brass locket with a picture of a strangled woman, a girl child sewn through the crotch. Even if someone had told us young, this is not a key, nor a peacock feather, not a kite, nor a telephone. This is the kitchen sink, the grinding stone. Would we give ourselves more calmly over, feel less criminal joy when the thing comes, as it does come, clarifying grammar and the fixed and mutable stars. Well, in a sense, this is another poem about poetry. It's called Blue Rock, and it's dedicated to Miriam Diaz de Ocariz. Your chunk of lapis lazuli shoots its stain blue into the wine glass on the table. The full moon moving up the sky is plain as the dead rose and the live buds on one stem. No, this isn't Persian poetry I'm quoting. All this is here in North America, where I sit trying to kindle fire from what's already on fire, the light of a blue rock from Chile swimming in the apricot liquid called Eye of the Swan. This is a chunk of your world, a piece of your heart. I'm sorry. This is a chunk of your world, a piece of its heart. Split from the rest, does it suffer? You needn't tell me. Sometimes I hear it singing by the waters of Babylon in a strange land. Sometimes it just lies heavy in my hand with the heaviness of silent seismic knowledge. A blue rock in a foreign land, an exile, excised but never separated from the gashed heart, its mountains, winter rains, language, native sorrow. At the end of the 20th century, cardiac graphs of torture replied to poetry, line by line. In North America, the strokes of the stylus continue. The figures of terror are reinvented. All night, after I turn the lamp off, blotting wine glass, rock, and roses, leaving pages like this, scrawled with mistakes and love, falling asleep, but the stylus does not sleep. Cruelly the drum revolves. Cruelty writes its name. Once when I wrote poems, they did not change, left overnight on the page. They stayed as they were, and daylight broke on the lines, as on the clotheslines in the yard, heavy with clothes forgotten or left out for a better sun next day. But now I know what happens while I sleep, and when I wake, the poem has changed. The facts have dilated it or canceled it, and in every morning's light, your rock is there. This is a poem that I was writing over a whole year. I started out in great difficulty with it and put it away. And when I pulled it out again about 6 months later, I realized that the difficulty came from the fact that I was trying to write it in very short lines and that it was kind of crying out to be a poem of very long lines. And that had to do in part with reading the fact that I'd been reading Whitman and Robinson Jeffers and the Old Testament. In the meantime, it's called Yom Kippur 1984, which is when I began it. I finished it about a year later. A lot of the reason that I couldn't finish it sooner was that I had to find out what I was really writing about. It has two epigraphs. One is from a poem by Robinson Jeffers, who is a California poet and who wrote about the California coast where I'm now living and where I just arrived when I started writing this. And his line is as follows: I drew solitude over me on the long shore. And the other epigraph is from Leviticus, and it's a line referring to Yom Kippur, to the Day of Atonement, and how it shall be made holy. And it says, for whoever does not afflict his soul throughout this day shall be cut off from his people. So I had those two lines to work from. What is a Jew in solitude? What would it mean not to feel lonely or afraid, far from your own or those you have called your own? What is a woman in solitude? A queer woman or man? In the empty street, on the empty beach, in the desert, what in this world as it is can solitude mean? The glassy concrete octagon suspended from the cliffs with its electric gate, its perfected privacy, is not what I mean. The pickup with a gun parked at a turnout in Utah or the Golan Heights is not what I mean. The poet's tower facing the western ocean, acres of forest planted to the east, the woman reading in the cabin, her attack dog suddenly risen, is not what I mean. 3,000 miles from what I once called home, I open a book searching for some lines I remember about flowers, something to bind me to this coast as lilacs in the dooryard once bound me back there. Yes, lupins on a burnt mountainside, something that bloomed and faded and was written down in the poet's book forever. Opening the poet's book, I find the hatred in the poet's heart. This is from Jeffrey's poem. The hateful-eyed and human-bodied are all about me. You that love multitude may have them. Robinson Jeffers, multitude is the blur flung by distinct forms against these landward valleys and the farms that run down to the sea. The lupins are multitude, and the torched poppies, the gray Pacific unrolling its scrolls of surf, and the separate persons stooped over sewing machines in denim dust, bent under the shattering skies of harvest, who sleep by shifts in never-empty beds, have their various dreams. Hands that pick, pack, steam, stitch, strip, stuff, shell, scrape, scour, belong to a brain like no other. Must I argue the love of multitude in the blur, or defend a solitude of barbed wire and searchlights, the survivalist's final solution? Have I a choice? To wander far from your own, or those you have called your own, to hear strangeness calling you from far away and walk in that direction long and far, not calculating risk, to go to meet the stranger without fear or weapon, protection nowhere on your mind. The Jew on the icy, rutted road on Christmas Eve prays for another Jew. The woman in the ungainly, twisting shadows of the street, make those be a woman's footsteps, as if she could believe in a woman's God. Find someone like yourself. Find others. Agree you will never desert each other. Understand that any rift among you means power to those who want to do you in. Close to the center, safety. Toward the edges, danger. But I have a nightmare to tell. I am trying to say that to be with my people is my dearest wish, but that I also love strangers, that I crave separateness. I hear myself stuttering these words to my worst friends and my best enemies, who watch for my mistakes in grammar, my mistakes in love. This is the day of atonement. But do my people forgive me? If a cloud knew loneliness and fear, I would be that cloud. To love the stranger, to love solitude. Am I writing merely about privilege, about drifting from the center, drawn to edges, a privilege we can't afford in the world that is, who are hated as being of our kind, faggot kicked into the icy river, woman dragged from her stalled car into the mist-struck mountains, used and hacked to death, young scholar shot at the university gates on a summer evening walk, his prizes and studies nothing, nothing availing his blackness. Jew deluded that she's escaped the tribe, the laws of her exclusion, the men too holy to touch her hand. Jew who has turned her back on midrash and mitzvah, yet wears the chai on a thong between her breasts, hiking alone, bound with a swastika carved in her back at the foot of the cliffs. Did she die as queer or as Jew? Solitude, O taboo, endangered species. On the mist-struck spur of the mountain, I want a gun to defend you. In the desert, on the deserted street, I want what I can't have. Your elder sister, Justice, her great peasant's hand outspread, her eye half-hooded, sharp, and true. And I ask myself, have I thrown courage away? Have I traded off something I don't name? To what extreme will I go to meet the extremist? What will I do to defend my want or anyone's want to search for her spirit vision far from the protection of those she has called her own? Will I find, O solitude, your plumes, your breasts, your hair, against my face as in childhood, your voice like the mockingbird singing, yes, you are loved, why else this song? In the old places, anywhere. What is a Jew in solitude? What is a woman in solitude? A queer woman or man? When the winter flood tides wrench the tower from the rock, crumble the prophet's headland, and the farms slide into the sea. When Leviathan is endangered, and Jonah becomes revenger, when center and edges are crushed together, the extremities crushed together on which the world was founded, when our souls crash together, Arab and Jew, howling our loneliness within the tribes, when the refugee child and the exile's child reopen the blasted and forbidden city, when we who refuse to be women and men as women and men are chartered, tell our stories of solitude spent in multitude. In that world, as it may be, newborn and haunted, what will solitude mean? This is called North American Time. When my dreams showed signs of becoming politically correct, no unruly images escaping beyond borders, when walking in the street I found my themes cut out for me, knew what I would not report for fear of enemies' usage, then I began to wonder. Everything we write will be used against us or against those we love. These are the terms, take them or leave them. Poetry never stood a chance of standing outside history. One line typed 20 years ago can be blazed on a wall in spray paint to glorify art as detachment or torture of those we did not love but also did not want to kill. We move, but our words stand. Become responsible for more than we intended. And this is verbal privilege. Try sitting at a typewriter one calm summer evening at a table by a window in the country. Try pretending your time does not exist, that you are simply you, that the imagination simply strays like a great moth, unintentional. Try telling yourself you are not accountable to the life of your tribe, the breath of your planet. It doesn't matter what you think. Words are found responsible. All you can do is choose them, or choose to remain silent. Or you never had a choice. Which is why the words that do stand are responsible. And this is verbal privilege. Suppose you want to write of a woman braiding another woman's hair, straight down or with beads and shells, in three-strand plaits or cornrows. You had better know the thickness, the length, the pattern, why she decides to braid her hair, how it is done to her, what country it happens in, what else happens in that country. You have to know these things. Poet, sister, words, whether we like it or not, stand in a time of their own. No use protesting. I wrote that before Kollontai was exiled. Rosa Luxemburg, Malcolm, Anna May Aquash, murdered. Before Treblinka, Birkenau, Hiroshima, before Sharpeville, Biafra, Bangladesh, Boston, Atlanta, Soweto, Beirut, Assam. Those faces, names of places, sheared from the almanac of North American time. I am thinking this in a country where words are stolen out of mouths as bread is stolen out of mouths, where poets don't go to jail for being poets, but for being dark-skinned, female, poor. I am writing this in a time when anything we write may be used against those we love, where the context is never given, though we try to explain over and over. For the sake of poetry, at least, I need to know these things. Sometimes, gliding at night in a plane over New York City, I have felt like some messenger called to enter, called to engage this field of light and darkness. A grandiose idea born of flying. But underneath the grandiose idea is the thought that what I must engage after the plane has raged onto the tarmac, after climbing my old stairs, sitting down at my old window, is meant to break my heart and reduce me to silence. In North America, time stumbles on without moving, only releasing a certain North American pain. Julio de Burgos wrote, "That my grandfather was a slave is my grief. Had he been a master, that would have been my shame." A poet's words hung over a door in North America in the year 1983. The almost full moon rises, timelessly speaking of change. Out of the Bronx, the Harlem River, the drowned towns of the Quabbin, the pilfered burial grounds, the pilfered burial mounds, the toxic swamps, the testing grounds. And I start to speak again. Finish with a very short poem. It's called Edges. In the sleepless sleep of dawn, in the dreamless dream. The kingfisher cuts through, flashing spirit fire from his wings. Bluer than violet's edge, the slice of those wings. 5 a.m., first light. Hobos of the past are leaning through the window. What freight cars did they hop here I thought I'd left behind? Their hands are stretched out, but not for bread. They are past charity. They want me to hear their names. Outside in the world where so much is possible, sunrise rekindles, and the kingfisher, the living kingfisher, not that flash of vision, darts where the creek drags her wetness over swamp and stone, where poison oak reddens, acacia pods collect, curled and secretive against the bulkhead. And the first light ghosts go transparent while the homeless line for bread. Thank you.